Today in Studio 360, a play about white flight in the 1950s and gentrification today. That should make pretty much everyone uncomfortable.
People have said to me, you talk about really controversial topics in a somewhat cavalier way. You act like you're shocked that people get mad.
The Pulitzer Prize winner Bruce Norris. His terrific play, Clybourne Park, is up for a bunch of Tony Awards next weekend. And a comedian on Broadway inspires a kid from the Bronx to try show business.
There's nobody like Whoopi.
And I told my mother I didn't want to be black no more. I did.
She was profane and profound, not just saying funny things, but saying true things.
We'll also hear about a new species of video game. Quirky, personal, and low budget. That's all ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today I'll introduce our next big redesign project. And I mean big. Here's a hint. What do these people have in common?
Michael Bublé.
Wade DeSarmo.
Shania Twain.
Joni Mitchell.
Samantha Bee.
Alec Trebek.
That's later in the hour, but we're going to start off on the other side of the Atlantic. All kinds of festivities are underway in London right now. It's Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee. Elizabeth has been Her Royal Highness to British and Commonwealth subjects for 60 years now. But back when she was crowned, it must have seemed pretty improbable that the British monarchy would still be going strong in the 21st century. To judge from the numbers of Americans and people all over the world who obsessed over the last royal wedding, the monarchy may be as popular as it's ever been. One American in the thick of all things British and royal is Sally Bedell Smith. She's the author of a new biography, Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch, and she joins me by phone from London. Hi, Sally.
Hello, Kurt.
So if I were British, I think I might be thinking right now, oh, we just did the Golden Jubilee 10 years ago, and we've got an Olympics coming up in a couple of months. Oh, what is the mood there?
The mood is it's you can feel it building by the hour. I mean, we walked out the other night to have dinner at a restaurant down the street, and we came back, and the street next to where we're staying was suddenly festooned with huge Union Jacks all up and down the street.
And it's not just all that stuff is not just for you guys, you and us, the tourists. They really you think it's really something they care about.
It is, and I think it's an expression of their wanting to celebrate this extraordinary woman who has been on the throne for six decades. The only other to surpass that was her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, who managed to, you know, stay on the throne for almost 64 years and celebrated her Diamond Jubilee in 1897
is one thing when Victoria's Britain was still at the top of the heap. But here in 2012, what is this queen doing to keep her image modern?
You know, if you look, one of her private secretaries called it the Marmite theory of monarchy, which I just loved, which is based on the famous Marmite.
Which
food.
No one outside the UK likes.
Which no one outside people in this country like. I just had some Marmite-covered cashews the other day, and I went, ew, as most Americans do. But anyway, the Marmite jar is this unbelievably familiar presence in everybody's kitchen. And you look at the Marmite jar, and you look at the label, and you think, I've known this label for 50 years. But in fact, if you look at it 50 years ago, it was quite different, and they have incrementally changed it over time. And this particular senior advisor to the Queen kind of adopted that as the theory of how she has incrementally modernized the monarch, especially post-Diana, but even before that.
Well, given that I, and I think a lot of people, really look at the royal family, especially over the last half century, as this ongoing serial soap opera romantic potboiler, Diana was this great new character who provided all these plot twists from the wedding, the adulteries, the divorce, her death, the aftermath of the death. It's like the most amazing reality show ever. Is that how the British people see the royal family, as this, as the biggest reality show superstars who've ever been?
I mean, I think they probably take the long view that the royal family's been around for, you know, monarchs have been around for 1,000 years. But, you know, let's face it, in the 80s and 90s, it was a royal soap opera, and the British viewed it the same way that everybody around the world did. I think the royal family is now functioning so much better because everything has calmed down. And
yeah,
one of the messages, probably subliminal, that the Queen is sending during all these Jubilee festivities is that there is royal family solidarity again.
And do they understand given their fluency with the modern media MO, do the people around her understand that movies like The Queen, in which she's depicted wonderfully, and King's Speech, where as a child she's depicted cutely and wonderfully, that those are good things for the royal family?
Absolutely. I've traveled around, you know, overseas and around the UK with the Queen and Prince Philip and their entourage, and the press people almost act like producers. They figure out what backgrounds work best and what mm-hmm. photo angles work best, and it's a very sophisticated operation, and they understand the need for royal branding, as it were. And the Queen, as you say, was very well aware of the fact that the film The Queen and then the film The King's Speech were very good for the royal brand.
Do you think at the end of this century, will there be a king or queen of the United Kingdom to whom anyone pays attention?
I think there's a pretty good chance. I mean, that's one of the questions that people ask. You know, will there be a monarchy in 50 years? And a pretty high proportion of people say that they think it will. And I guess what struck me is that particularly in these times when there's a lot of political division and political corruption, and there's a real value in having somebody who is above politics. You know, it does have a value to separate the head of state from the head of government.
Thank you, Sally.
You're welcome.
Sally Bedell-Smith is the author of Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. Where are you going to be on the day itself, Jubilee Day?
Well, there are going to be 4 days. For the river pageant, I'm going to watch it from a friend's flat. I just decided I didn't want to brave the crowds.
How queen-like of you.
How queen-like, I know.
Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee is taking place this weekend. And speaking of countries where people talk a little funny, over the last few years on this show, we've been proposing makeovers of institutions like Christmas, the gay pride flag, Uncle Sam, teachers. And now it gives me great pleasure to announce our next rebranding project. Canada. Yep, the whole country. You know, that one right above Maine and Minnesota and Washington State. Why are we doing this? Well, what do you know about Canada? Hockey, Celine Dion, Molson Ale, Mounties, and that's about it, right? It's embarrassing.
Do you know the capital of Canada?
No.
No? Unfortunately, I don't.
Toronto?
Toronto? No.
Is it Montreal or Quebec? One of those.
Alberta?
No idea.
It's something with a T, right?
Quebec is the capital.
Is there a national capital?
I'm pretty sure there is one, and I'm pretty sure it's Ottawa. You can hear in that pop quiz we did on the street that we need to do something to fix Canada's image in America, to make it more vivid, more memorable, more sticky. And here's where you come in. send us a slogan that sells Canada to Americans, like this excellent one we got from our listener David Fuller, who happens to be a Canadian in Winnipeg. His slogan, "We're not just colder, we're cooler." So go to redesigningcanada.com and help us help Canada. Coming up, a young actress is the hottest thing on Broadway, and don't get in her way.
There are too many people who have killed themselves to help me, and it would be a real shame if I didn't do 100% of what I could.
Tony nominee Nina Ariande is up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The Tony Awards are next weekend, and they're going to be interesting. It's been an exceptionally good year for new plays on Broadway. Claiborne Park, Other Desert Cities, and Venus in Fur by David Ives. It is about a playwright who's adapted an erotic novel for the stage, and he's having a hell of a time casting the lead. Then he meets a young, spectacular actress named Vanda.
This is based on an old German novel called Venus in Fur, singular, by Leopold von Sacher Masoch.
I bet you read German. I bet you read it in German.
Well, I did, actually. Yeah. Anyway, the book was a huge scandal in 1870.
Well, sure. I mean, basically, it's S&M porn.
No, it's not S&M porn.
You don't think it's porn? Or pornish? For medieval times, I mean, 18 whatever.
Venus in Fur is a great love story. It's a serious novel. It's a central text of world literature.
Oh, I thought from the play it had to be porn, but anyway. You don't have to tell me about sadomasochism, okay? I'm in the theater.
Nina Ariande is up for a Tony for her portrayal of the sly, sexy Vanda, but she says in real-life showbiz, her looks have sometimes worked against her. They'd say she was too ethnic, too tall, too big.
I think the worst thing was when I was a kid, my mother kind of was my manager in a certain way, I guess, and we got a call from an agent who told her that I needed to cut my hair and lose 10 pounds. And I was a pretty skinny 10-year-old at that point, and that was pretty offensive. It was kept from me for a while.
I was going to say, did your mom say, hey, yeah, you got to lose 10 pounds?
Oh,
no.
Quite the opposite. She used a couple of choice words and hung up the phone, and we certainly didn't deal with him anymore.
Good for her. Did you have some kind of mantra that you said to yourself that kept you going as you were rejected or all the vicissitudes that actors face?
I don't know if there's a specific mantra, but I think just kind of, failure is not an option. There are too many people who have killed themselves to help me, you know, in my life. And it would be a real shame if I didn't do 100% of what I could.
And the people that helped you, meaning your parents, teachers?
Parents, teachers, coaches that I've had throughout my life, you know. People who really have invested in me emotionally, you know, professionally.
Is it true your first performance, public performance, was when you were three reciting a Ukrainian poem?
It was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of that?
The poem?
Yeah.
Oh, which one is it? No, I don't. Oh, my mom's going to be upset. She knows that, though. I don't remember it.
And was that a moment where you thought, if you can remember, I guess you remember it, like, whoa, this is great. This is what I want to do?
Yeah, because I finished the poem. And we practiced everything at home. We practiced, obviously, the actual words. We did, you know, entrance and exits and curtsying, everything. The one thing that we didn't practice was receiving applause, which was mind-blowing to me when I was three. And my curtsying got out of hand, and so on tape, we just have me repeatedly.
Oh, really? There's a video of this?
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to get this.
No, I don't know where it is. I lost it.
You have now been in movies. I saw you in Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's movie.
Yes.
As you specify your dreams, do you think it's going to be this much movies, this much stage, this much this? Do you have that in mind?
I would love to continue working in film, and I certainly could never leave the theater. So that if I could, yes, that's where I would love to continue.
Really? And if they said, now you're a movie star, we're going to pay you $1 jillion to make these great movies, you wouldn't give up the theater then?
No.
Really?
No.
Is that truly... Is it just more intense? It better uses your particular talents? What is it?
There's nothing like a live experience. Whether you're, sitting in the audience or you're on stage, there's really nothing like it. I remember reading an article by Wendy Wasserstein where she said, I'm not going to quote this correctly, but there's nothing like sharing a laugh with strangers in the dark. And I remember cutting that and putting it in my scrapbook. That really just... There really isn't. And when you're out there and you're with people and you're all a part of it, the audience is a very much part of the story, too.
Unmediated by putting on a film and sending it out into the world.
Right. And for me, there's just something in me that I couldn't exchange that experience for the world. And I'm not a tweeter or a Facebooker, and I really value FaceTime. And, to me, theater is more meaningful. No way.
If that's the choice, theater versus Twitter,
right.
I'll go with you.
I'm going to go.
Yeah. And are you yet at the point where you don't really have to audition? You're so magnificent that they just hire you for jobs?
No, I'm still auditioning.
Yeah?
I'm not that magnificent yet.
Well, give it a few months.
Sure.
Nina Arianda, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
You hit me once, I hit you back. You gave a kick, I gave a slap. You smashed a plate over my head, then I set fire to our bed.
Nina Arianda is the star of Venus in Fur, and she's up for a Tony Award next weekend.
You smashed a plate over my head, then I set fire to our bed.
Another great play that has racked up nominations is Clybourne Park. The first act is set in 1959, the second in 2009. Same actors, different characters, same neighborhood, different versions of the same issue. Race, class, misunderstanding. At the beginning, a white couple is selling their house, and they discover they've sold it to a black family, and their white neighbors are upset. Bruce Norris won the Pulitzer Prize for the play.
It was very important to me to depict the people in 1959, the first act, as good intention people with good intentions.
Nobody's a black hat villain.
No, of course not. I mean, they're not racists in the sort of KKK way. They're not skinheads. They're people who think that they're doing the right thing to protect their neighborhood and their children and their real estate values. I mean, that's the things they're trying so hard to protect. But that's a form of self-interest that has as its unfortunate byproduct a really racist and awful outcome.
And for all we know, this family could be perfectly lovely.
Well, that's hardly the point, is it?
Maybe it's a point to consider.
Bev, I'm not here to solve society's problems. I'm simply telling you what will happen, and it will happen as follows. First, one family will leave, then another. And each time they do, the values of these properties will decline. And once that process begins, once you break that egg, Bev, all the king's horses, etc. And some of us, you see, those who don't have the opportunity to simply pick up and move at the drop of a hat, well, those folks are left holding the bag.
That is the Broadway cast of the great play Clybourne Park, written by Bruce Norris. So the jumping off point for this play is Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, which also became a movie, about a black family who buys a house in a white neighborhood and struggles there. Your play is essentially a prequel and a sequel. It starts off before the action in that play happens.
Well, I guess it's sort of a parallel play. Is there a quill that goes along with that? It's sort
of parallel quill.
Yeah, exactly. The first act of my play is contemporaneous, if that's the right word, with the Hansberry play, and in fact actually steals a character from her play.
That main character.
The guy who you just heard talking, a character called Carl Lindner in Lorraine Hansberry's and my play. Who is a community representative who's dispatched from Clybourne Park in the Hansberry play to ask that family not to move in. And he, in my play, appears in the first act to relay that same information to the white family and ask them not to sell.
Was the Hansberry play, Raisin in the Sun, something that you'd thought about a long time, thinking, oh, we need to show the other side of this?
Well, you know, I was exposed to that play at a very early age. And
as a child?
Yeah. Well, probably about age 12 or 13. You know, I think a social studies teacher or something like that thought it would be something useful for us to see because I was...
How 70s of her.
Yes, exactly. But you know, I was from a neighborhood in Texas that was extremely segregated. And the school district had been isolated from the rest of the Houston school district, you know, by law, to establish a kind of boundary where only a certain kind of rich upper middle class student was allowed to go there, which was de facto a white school system. And I suppose when I saw that, either my school teacher was subversive or just crafty or something, and she sort of put this idea into our heads, basically letting us know in an indirect way that we were the inheritors of that legacy.
The second half of the play takes place 50 years later in 2009, more or less now. And the now black neighborhood is in the process of becoming white again, gentrified, as we call it. Mm-hmm. There's a white couple buying this same house that the first act takes place in. And all these white neighbors and one black couple gather to talk gingerly at first. But it's still... comes out a mess.
There was this great article 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you saw this, about the history of the changing ethnic
distribution.
Oh, I
should read that.
In the 70s and 80s, how that was followed by a period of rapid
decline.
No, not trouble.
She didn't mean
there was trouble.
Well, economic trouble.
Drugs are trouble.
That's what I'm saying.
Violence is trouble.
Exactly. And the violence as an outgrowth of the criminalization of those drugs.
Because you know, the two of us was both crackheads. I'm just kidding.
That's funny.
I think we the white people, need a little schooling in how not to talk. I think we bungle it perpetually. We just get the conversation wrong over and over again, no matter how hard we try. And we trip ourselves up because we're trying so hard not to offend, and we wind up doing exactly the opposite.
I mean, nobody is the character in this play, certainly in the second act, whom you as an audience member say, oh, yeah, that's the person that would be me.
I think one of the interesting things about audiences is that they have this sort of childlike need to identify who their hero is in a story and to sort of root for them and get behind them. And one of my favorite things to do as a writer is to sort of confound that impulse. There's an interesting moment in the second act, and a couple times this has happened, where that same character at one point voices his opposition to people who would have yellow ribbon magnets on their big SUVs because that would be in support of this terrible war. And frequently, after he says that, we get applause from the audience. I don't want to.
And then you make those people feel bad
moments
later.
Exactly, because they've then run afoul of something someone else feels in the room. And one thing that's dependable about liberals, and, you know, the market for new plays is by and large, you know, liberal-leaning people. The one thing that's really predictable about them is they don't like to hurt people's feelings, that sometimes overrides all other concerns.
When I write something, especially fiction, it's to figure out what I think actually think about something and why and in detail. Is that how you write these sort of social plays?
I tend to get in arguments with people a lot, and I more often than not I lose the argument. So what happens is I go home and I stew about why I lost. And after I stew for a long enough time, I start to divide up the parts of the argument among various people and various voices. And that's usually the genesis of a play.
So that the play is simply the answer to the argument that you didn't get the last word in on?
Well, it's the replay of the argument, the endless contentious replay of it in my head.
What was the argument that was the germ for Claiborne Park?
I was in this is during the early days of the Iraq War. I was in a restaurant with some friends of mine, and I was saying something about how we shouldn't support this, whatever. And someone said, well, you know what? You should always support the troops. And I said, well, why if I don't agree with what the cause is? And they said, because minorities are overrepresented in the troops. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, because, you know, there's a greater proportion of blacks and Latinos.
That's a bad argument for supporting the troops.
Absolutely.
But anyway.
And I said, you're telling me that on the basis of the sensitivity of a certain demographic, I should change my position about life and death issue. I said, that's a terrible rationale. So that was what got me thinking about how we you know, overcomplicate the discussion of race with a lot of useless ideas.
You have said more than once the following. Art is to society as Christmas ornaments are to a tree. They make the tree prettier, but it's still a dead tree. Are you being humble as an artist or realistically pessimistic about the world?
I think that if art made the world better, it'd be very difficult to explain why Shakespeare precedes the Holocaust. I mean, I'm descriptive.
But the vice president just told us that Will and Grace made gay marriage possible.
That's right. I
But you don't ever think of, oh, I'm improving the world by writing this play shaping the discourse?
No, no. I'm descriptive, not prescriptive. I have no idea what the better world is. Playwrights generally, by and large, write plays that reflect something that they see, and some try to influence the future. I think those plays,
and they shall not be long remembered.
I don't know.
You're an actor as well.
Well, sometimes.
Well, you started out really as an. I mean, that's what the career you were pursuing as a young man.
Yes, it's true.
How did you flip over?
To be an actor requires that you submit to the vision of someone else. And because I'm a very difficult, contrary, unpleasant, irritating human being, I'm not the right psychological type to be an actor.
I can see that. You don't seem like an actor.
I tried very hard for a long time, to some success. And
you're much more like a writer than you are an actor, just if I can stereotype a bit.
Well,
racially profile or something.
Like pale-skinned and argumentative, something like that.
Yeah. Those could be along the line.
Nearsighted. Yeah.
Yeah. So, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, keep writing plays.
Thank you.
Confidential as a church at twilight.
Confidential.
Sentimental as a rose in the moonlight.
I love you.
My love for you will always be.
Confidential.
Confidential to me.
Clybourne Park is playing on Broadway now, and it's nominated for 4 Tony Awards, including Best Play. You can hear my full conversation with the playwright, Bruce Norris, at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can hear more from this year's Tony nominees, including the playwright John Robin Bates and the British comedian James Corden. In Texas, Austin is the town with the hip rock bands, and San Antonio is where it's at for Tejano and mariachi bands. But right now, this is the hottest band coming out of San Antonio.
Just because, oh.
It's a trio of young women called Girl in a Coma. They just won an independent music award for their new record, Exits and All the Rest. Studio 360's Lee Tom Olad talked to the band about how they got started with a 13-year-old singer.
Jen Alva and Fonny Diaz met in art class when they were 12. They bonded over Nirvana and their Reebok high tops. They instantly knew they wanted to do one thing, start a band. Jen and Fonny have been playing music together ever since.
You know, when you're 20 and you haven't gone to college and you're trying to find, like, what did you do with yourself?
Right.
We've always loved
We were
going
to go to the Navy at one point. And in our mall that we worked at, we knew the Navy people and they were really sweet to us. So we went in and we applied and they said, well, you know, you have to drop like 5 pounds and everything's going to be so wonderful. And we just were like, what were we thinking? And I'm glad we did it.
We knew we wanted to do music. We just could never find people to click with. It was just always Jen and I looking. We got lucky.
I don't know if I'd call it luck. More like destiny.
I want to wash all of your clothes.
The person they were looking for was there all along. Fani's little sister, Nina.
And scratch you when you got an itch. I do, I do.
One day we were hanging out on our front porch and she came out and said, can I show you this song that, you know, that I have? And I'm like, yeah, you know, whatever. We kind of like, whatever, she's young. She was 12 at the time and we were 20. As soon as she opened her mouth, we were completely blown away. We actually thought it was a cover she was doing, and it was something she had written. I mean, Jen and I right then and there were like, she's got to be in the band. Doesn't matter how old she is.
Nina's still young. She's just 24. But her voice is a powerhouse.
Am I just another figure to call?
When I was trying to get my own voice, I would always sing along to whoever I was listening to, like Bjork, Jeff Buckley, and then Morrissey. So in the beginning, you can kind of tell some words that I sing sound like him a bit. Hopefully now it's kind of become my own voice.
You can definitely hear the influence of Morrissey and his former band, The Smiths. Girl in a Coma got their name from a Smiths song.
Girlfriend in a coma, I know, it's serious.
When the girls were teenagers, they idolized Morrissey, especially Nina. Their bedrooms were plastered with Morrissey posters.
And I was just like, it hurt so much that I like loved him. I turned vegetarian after that, started reading Oscar Wilde and eating yogurt and bagels and trying to be like him.
We had posters all around the room. We would talk to the posters and like, we're not crazy.
A couple years ago, they got their dream call. It was Morrissey himself, inviting them to join him on tour. So what was it like to finally meet the man in the posters? Now the girls are totally blasé about it.
When we got to open up for him, everything just switched, and the whole fan inside just shredded off, and it was time to work.
Yellow. Everyone around you, they're just asking. Everyone around you, they're just asking.
You get the sense that Girl in a Coma has too much of a work ethic to be starstruck. They've been going at this for 10 years, and they're not even in their 30s. When Nina joined the band, barely 13, Fani had to convince their mom that they weren't just screwing around.
At first, our mother was very, you know, believing this was like a hobby, something fun for Nina to do while she's young. But it wasn't until she saw, like, how I was just sacrificing a lot and Nina dropped out of school, and that was the big decision there for my mom to let her come out of school, because all she ever wanted was for us to get our diplomas and, you know, just be comfortable with life. And she just basically told Jen and I, look, she's in your hands, you know, I see that you guys really want to do this, so let her go. And
now they're like our biggest supporters, the girls' parents. They're fantastic.
And music runs in the Diaz family. Their grandfather was a Tejano musician. They named their second album, Trio BC, after his band. And for the first time, they recorded a song in Spanish. Do you guys speak Spanish? Are you bilingual?
I'm probably the most...
She's probably bisexual.
Wow. Okay, anyways. I understand it very well, but I speak it funny, like very Tex-Mex. And they want to learn. And Jen's got that Rosetta Stone program.
We almost feel like we're being bad, you know, mm-hmm. Latinas. So, you know, Nina said it best one time. She said that we don't have a choice. It's right there breathing down our necks, you know, our culture, our heritage.
I think it definitely gave us the passion. I mean, there's a lot of passion in Spanish singers, and I think that in itself, and watching our grandfather, that's what we took from that, is just to never give up and love it.
For Studio 360, I'm Lital Malad.
Girl in a Coma's latest record is called Exits and All the Rest, and they are on tour right now. Coming up, the state of the art in video games has graphics that astound. But it turns out all you need to keep people entertained is a cow.
You know, much to my chagrin, clicking on a cow was actually a sufficient entertainment experience, it turned out, not just a way to critique the kind of perverse entertainment experience that I saw in games like Farmville.
Video games go indie. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and I just wanted to let you know that we have unveiled two new ways for you to experience Studio 360 on your smartphone, your iPad, or other tablet. You can see, read, and listen to the show through our new Google Currents edition or using the Flipboard app, and you can download both for free. Now, a pop quiz. Which is bigger, the percentage of Americans who go to the movies or the percentage of Americans who play video games? It's gaming. Gaming is now the great American pastime. 72% versus 67% who went to the movies last year. That's according to the Entertainment Software Association. And just like with movies, video games come in different sizes. The blockbusters everyone's heard of, and the small releases that sell in the thousands rather than the millions, quirkier, artisanal games that get known by word of mouth. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky went to track some of them down.
On a Saturday night in Brooklyn, I walk through an empty industrial neighborhood until I come to a warehouse door full of light and music. About 50 people are inside playing video games. Guys have beards, women wear vintage glasses. I'm probably the oldest person in the room.
Yeah.
It looks kind of like the 80s arcades I used to go to, filled with the clunky, stand-up wooden consoles that would house a game like Donkey Kong or Frogger. But the arcade cabinets are completely homemade.
Oh, you took it! Oh, I died!
And there's a game in the back that's set up like an Atari system. The players sit on a couch across from a TV.
We control the game by, like, clicking these red buttons on our bras.
Yes, he said bras. The players have to wear hardwired B-cup lingerie. The game designer Anna Anthropy is watching nearby.
It's more like being a playwright and watching people perform your play. It's every game is a performance, every game is different. It's theirs as much as it's mine.
There's nothing nostalgic about our arcade. Like, we use the arcade as a platform to exhibit games.
That's Sayud Saladin. He and his friend Kunal Gupta are founders of Baby Castles, the group that stages these makeshift arcades. Now, these guys grew up in the 90s, playing Nintendo in their living rooms. They want to bring games back into the real world, making them a social experience. They designed a Space Invaders-type game that people were able to play on the ceiling of the planetarium.
From what I can tell, it was the first game made for a planetarium.
But their main goal is to shine a spotlight on quirky, independent games.
There isn't that space of recognizing really great games and celebrating them. Like, we kind of do it, but on the scale compared to Sundance or, like, whatever, it's really, really small.
In the independent game world, there's no one like Harvey Weinstein, you know, a mogul who could discover a little gem and promote it around the world. A lot of indie game makers end up selling their labors of love to these huge gaming websites.
And people just don't have the attention time to go through, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of choices of games.
Ian Bogust makes games about, well, whatever he wants. One of his games made fun of airport security. In another game, you try to run a Kinko's copy shop, but you're set up to fail.
Get out of my way. I don't
were trying to service these customer orders with employees that didn't do what you want, or they'd kind of stop working, or they couldn't find anything.
Get out of my way.
A couple years ago, he decided to create the dumbest game you could possibly think of as an act of protest. It was called Cow Clicker. You earn points by clicking a cute cartoon cow over and over again. The game was a blockbuster.
You know, much to my chagrin, clicking on a cow was actually a sufficient entertainment experience, it turned out, not just a way to critique the kind of perverse entertainment experience that I saw in games like Farmville.
So he could make the next Farmville, but he doesn't want to. Bogost built an online studio that promotes niche games, and he's holding on to his day job, teaching video game design at Georgia Tech.
To me, a lot of independence has to do with making something that doesn't have a place yet.
One of the most interesting video game outsiders is Anna Anthropy. Just listen to the title of her new book.
The title of my book is Rise of the Video Game Zinesters: How Freaks, Normals, Amateurs, Artists, Dreamers, Dropouts, Queers, Housewives, and People Like You Are Taking Back an Art Form.
Anna's a transgendered woman. She tried hormone replacement therapy, but it was uncomfortable, even humiliating. In the end, she found a spot between genders where she feels okay about herself. So she made a video game about her sex change, or her attempt at one. It's called Dysphoria.
Trans women are so scared of their own voices. You know, it's hard for me to listen to my voice recorded a lot of the times. I wanted to sort of process that by putting my actual voice into this game about my experience as a transgendered woman.
It took 5 months to make the game because she had to take other work.
And then I'd come back to it and then I'd be a little farther along in my own process and, you know, the process of dealing with hormones, and suddenly I would know, like, what the next series of levels would be.
I played the game at home. I navigated a razor to catch chest hairs above pixelated breasts. I controlled a blocky figure through a women's bathroom, trying not to be seen.
A lot of people said that they would not have sympathized with the game as much if it had been, say, a blog entry or a video, because there's that level of empathy that comes from actually engaging with the rules and experiencing the frustration that I felt.
That's where personalized video games have a lot of power, and the technology to create them is getting easier. Soon, designing your own game will be as easy as making a video and posting it to YouTube.
The next 5 years, the next 10 years in video games are going to be so interesting because there's going to be so many voices coming into this art form that were not there previously. You'll be able to look on your grandmother's game page and maybe play a game that she made about her cat. That might be totally mundane, but it's still totally beautiful.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Malinsky.
Beep. Beep. Beep.
You can play some of the games Eric talked about in the story. We've got links at studio360.org. 1984. Gravatar was my personal favorite 25-cent game at the video arcade. Ronald Reagan was president. And a one-woman show ran for 156 sold-out performances on Broadway. It was called Whoopi.
How you doing, good-looking?
Great, great.
Good. My name is Fontaine, and love is my game. When I kiss the girls, hey, they all aflame. Come on, let me kiss your hand. Oh, this is a bad ring you got on.
Back in the day, Whoopi Goldberg was an edgy, up-and-coming 28-year-old comedian who did dozens of different characters. The show launched her career and inspired a generation of aspiring comics, including our listener Julie Bailey. The daughter of Jamaican immigrants, she grew up in New York, in the Bronx, where she says she never really fit in.
I went to a German Lutheran school from the time I was 6 years old. So every morning after the Pledge of Allegiance, we'd say, Guten Morgen, Herr Kaesmeier, and then classes would commence. So, you know, basically I grew up a raisin in a rice pudding. From, I got to tell you, maybe around 6 or 7 years old, I wanted to be a comedian. I just knew I wanted to make people laugh. Of course, my parents felt like all of that should be, you know, focused on jury summations. But I thought, you know, there was something else. And when I was growing up, there used to be a whole lot of shows on TV in the afternoon, like Merv Griffin had a show and Mike Douglas had a show, and they would always have these comedians. I was probably the only 8-year-old little black kid who had a crush on Rodney Dangerfield in like 1970. I never thought it was something that I could do, because I never saw anybody who looked like me doing that. And then when I was like 19 or 20, I saw Whoopi. And I remember I was sitting way up in the balcony, and out comes this chocolate brown woman, you know, into the spotlight. And she raises her head up, and, you know, I see this Cupid doll face.
Okay, like, I totally love to surf, you know, because, like, no, really, I do.
That's how I talked all the time. It's like, they called me a valley girl. They're like, where are you from in the Bronx? The valley? People around me were laughing, and I couldn't even laugh. It was funny, but I couldn't even laugh because I was mesmerized.
And, like, a lot of people come up to me and they go, like, are you a valley girl? And I go, no, I'm a surfer, because before there was the mall, there was the ocean, okay?
I used to be able to, 30 years ago, say the show word for word, but sort of a seminal moment was she does this piece, and I remember it so clearly. She puts this slip, a half slip, on her head, and, you know, she would pretend she was this beautiful, you know, blonde girl.
This is my long, luxurious blonde hair. Ain't it pretty? Oh, look, it's in my eyes now.
You know, everybody was laughing when she did that. And I was laughing, but I was crying too, because that was me. You know, you'd take the waistband and put it around your waist, then take your mom's bobby pins, you know, and pin it so that it would fit on your head. And then all the girls would just, you know, flip their hair back, and they would be so sexy and cool and fabulous. And, you know, I had pigtails. I couldn't do that.
I am, and she's going to want me to make them stop, but she ain't even going to know I'm there, because I'm going to have blonde hair, blue eyes, and I'm going to be white.
And you're going to ask me to tell you how it ends, and I can't remember, because I remember that I was tearing up a lot, you know.
And she said if I sat in a vat of Clorox till hell froze over, I wasn't going to be nothing but black. And she was right, too, because I sat in the Clorox and I got burned.
I'm normally not even ever speechless, but as I think back to that moment, it did change my life, because there was this woman who was unashamed of the way she looked and the way her hair looked and who she was. And she was up there not just saying funny things, but saying true things. And that was it. I said, okay, this is what I want to do. And, you know, I had to have an interesting conversation with my parents about the fact that, no, I'm not going to law or any other school. I'm going to California, and I'm going to be a comedian. That did not go well. So, you know, I'm packing my suitcase, my Lady Baltimore suitcase, and my mother's like, maybe you should be an architect. That's what you should do. She's like, I don't know what's going to happen when you don't come back from your vacation. I'm like, Mom, it's not a vacation. I'm leaving. So I went to L.A., and I would just go to comedy clubs, like, every night. I would do open mics, and I would just go up there. There's no, like, magic story to it. You know, I just sort of kept doing it until I just felt it wasn't clicking, and I stopped. So it did advertising. Let me tell you, I can make a presentation to 1,000 corporate eggheads because there ain't nothing like being in an open mic at 2 o'clock in the morning where there's like 7 people who are all drunk and they're throwing beer at you and you're trying to get through a set. What the hell can frighten me now? Nothing. There's nobody like Whoopi. She was profane and profound. And my aha moment with her was about comedy, but it was about life. How to live your life out loud. But it's
Julie Bailey, who listens to Studio 360 on WNYC. Have you had a life-changing experience after seeing a Broadway show or a Hollywood movie or read a novel or listened to a record? If so, write to us at studio360.org and we might put your aha moment on the air. Derek John produced our story with help from Krista Ripple. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. And don't forget our Rebranding Canada project. You can be part of the first stage by coming up with a slogan that sells Canada to Americans. You can find out more about the project at redesigningcanada.com. And by the way, there's a great Studio 360-ish Canadian radio program, Rebranding America, at the same time. So you may want to see what they're plotting at that same address, redesigningcanada.com. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Shi Cheng Lin,
Julia Barton,
Krista Ripple,
Mujahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Sarah Gook.
And thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Bantiga.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, there's something wrong with the way we see our neighbors to the north.
But it's not what you think of us, Kurt. It's that you don't think of us.
So, we're rebranding Canada.
We grow up in our schools learning all about the United States and history and culture, and we don't really feel like that's reciprocated.
Redesigning Canada, that's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.